In the beginning, Ibiza's ancient wells were sacred places of fertility, life and renewal, temples to the moon goddess Tanit. But slowly the people started forgetting, and the more they worshipped the god of the sun, the more the wells began to dry. You're listening to The Wells of Tanit, a podcast celebrating the folklore, mythology, history and ecology of the island of Ibiza. My name is Joanna Ruby. I'm an artist and puppeteer and the founder of Theatre of the Ancients, and we're about to journey together to one of Ibiza's wells to see what stories it has to tell us. Don't be afraid, take my hand, and let's go and find the Wells of Tanit. Suspended lionface spilling at the centre of an unfurnished sky. How still you stand, and how unaided. Single, stalkless flower, you pour unrecompensed. The eye sees you simplified by distance into an origin. Your petaled head of flames continuously exploding. Heat is the echo of your gold. Coined there among lonely horizontals, you exist openly. Our needs hourly climb and return like angels. Unclosing like a hand, you give forever. That is the poem Solar by Philip Larkin. And it's the perfect poem to introduce episode 3 of this podcast, themed around the sun. And that poem was a perfect introduction on many levels. But above all, because today I'm talking to you from a well which is so unknown and hard to find, like, let's face it, like a lot of the wells on the island of Ibiza. But this one, when you find the stone path, lead down it into this very fertile valley between San Mateo and Santa Catrudis, past orange trees on your right-hand side, and a mysterious little house with some red and white painted decorations around the doors and windows, you finally come to this well, to the Font del Miquelet. And when you open the gate, which I was worried for a moment that it was padlocked, but actually the padlock isn't locked, and you go inside the cave-like chamber where I'm sitting now, you find, at the end, a fresco painted above the well on 3 walls. It's painted in red manganese oxide, contrasting with the kind of warm honey-coloured stone and plaster underneath. And amongst the geometric designs, which are fairly typical of Ibizan folklore, you find them on the typical instruments like the flutes, which are carved out of oleander wood. But in the centre there's a particular motif which has captured my imagination from the beginning. And people say that it's a Middle Eastern tree of life. There are 6 long leafy stalks stretching upwards. And just above them is, just like in Philip Larkin's poem, a many-petaled flower sitting there in the centre, which people say represents the sun, as is typical in the Tree of Life design. And this fresco has fascinated me since I first heard about it and then found my way to this well, which is very badly signposted. And what has fascinated me even more is that despite the fact that it is supposedly a symbol representing the Tree of Life with the sun at the top of it, legend has it that once upon a time, above the Tree of Life symbol, there was a symbol to, you guessed it, Tanit, the moon goddess, the ancient Carthaginian moon goddess of the island. But that symbol has since disappeared. And in this episode, you're going to join me on a little bit of a magical mystery tour to find out as much as I possibly could about this fresco and that missing symbol, but more on that later. So it's no coincidence that the chosen topic of this month, sun, coincides with the month of August, the hottest month of the year, when generally for people who live permanently on the island, it's a matter of survival, really. And August is a strange month because the two island populations, I guess you could say the permanent and the temporary populations, divide into two very different camps. The residents, or most of them, sort of shrink away from outdoor life, and it's almost as if they start living and moving in slow motion. You see them slowly pacing down the streets, on the side of the street that's in the shade, of course. It's a sort of a hibernation month, and in fact somebody once told me that the Ibithencos traditionally call these months of the year the Ibithenco winter, and I can totally understand that. But whilst, on the other hand, the other slightly more transient population of the island comes out and searches for the sun, seeks it, embraces it, flocks to the beach. And indeed, a few days ago, it was reported in the local paper that 59,000 people were registered passing through the airport of Ibiza on one day. I think that was the 9th of August. All of them, you could more or less say, were searching for a kind of modern sun worship for which the island has become so famous. And whilst this modern sun worship is kicking off, the island is entering a pre-alert for drought because water levels have been reported to be down at 51%, and the local paper was talking about the possibility of there being a shortage of desalinated water later on in August. So this little pouring of rain yesterday probably has barely scratched the surface, but we're thankful for it. So if modern day sun worship were a religion, you could say that the island of Ibiza is a kind of a Mecca. And I wonder whether this modern sun worship started on a particular day in a particular year, and I think that year might be 1953. Because in that year, in the Bay of San Antonio, which has since then become known as the hotspot of debauched hedonistic behaviour on the island, especially by British people, there was a very interesting photograph taken by the Barcelona photographer Oriol Maspons. And it shows a woman, a foreign woman, I think she's French, wearing a bikini, surrounded by women wearing the typical Ibizan dress, which is long, heavy skirts, high neckline, blouses, headscarf, wide-brimmed straw hats. And according to the son of the photographer, Oriol Maspons, these local women had eyes as big as plates that day. So I suppose a major shift happened around about the 1950s when people on this island started derobing themselves, and instead of hiding away from the sun inside of their very, very thick-walled finca traditional houses, which protected them from the heat in summer and kept them warm in the winter, people started embracing the sun and heading to those little sandy bits of coastline. I can't remember what they're called. Oh yes, beaches, where previously people went to occasionally dip their feet in the water and get into their fishing boats. And then, of course, the hippies arrived in late 50s, early 60s, into the 70s. And of course, then there were naked people wandering all over the island. But according to some maybe slightly romantic people, the Ibithencos didn't bat an eyelid because they were very open-minded. And that's something which people say again and again. And I wonder whether it's because it conveniently fits their theory of Ibiza being an island where you can do whatever you want, good or bad. And after the hippies came the tourists, And now, what do you know? About 5 million tourists every year flock to the sandy edges of this island to embrace the sun. But what I want to know is, going back to the ancient roots of this island, was there a sun-worshipping culture back in time? The ancient cultures which are said to have solar religions are the Egyptian, the Indo-European, and the Mesoamerican. And all of these have ideas associated with sacred kingship. In other words, the kings of those lands were equated with the power of the sun. And the sun was known to be the ruler of the upper and the lower worlds. And in the Britannica Encyclopedia, it says, "The sun is the bestower of light and life to the totality of the cosmos. With his unblinking, all-seeing eye, he is the stern guarantor of justice. With the almost universal connection of light with enlightenment or illumination, the sun is the source of wisdom." And it was said that the kings of those lands ruled by the power of the sun and also claimed descent from the sun. So, of course, the ancient gods and goddesses of Ibiza came from the Egyptian lands via Carthage. And the main god of Carthage was the solar deity Baal Hamon, known as King of the Gods. And he was a fertility god, the Lord of Rain and Dew. But he came along with a consort called Tanit to Ibiza, and we'll talk a little bit more about that later. So the Carthaginians and the Phoenicians evolved into the Roman rulers of the island of Ibiza, and in the Roman times, sun worship gained in importance and led to what people refer to as a solar monotheism. So nearly all of the gods of that period were known as solar deities, and Christ himself acquired the traits of a solar deity. So the feast of Sol Invictus, or Unconquered Sun, was a festival on December the 25th each year, and of course that was eventually taken over by the Christians to become Christmas, the birth of Christ. And aside from all of that, solar worship is still going strong in all of Spain, not just the Balearic Islands, via the festival of San Juan, the Noche of San Juan, or St. John's Eve, which is basically the pagan midsummer solstice celebrations of Spain, the longest night of the year. And in Ibiza, it's particularly live and kicking. Up in the north, in a small village called San Juan, it's an event which many people flock to each year. My giant puppets have known to parade on that night and accompany the procession up to the bonfires. It's a glorious pagan celebration, and it includes the burning of fires, the jumping through fires. It's known as a night of rebirth and purification. So yes, ancient sun worship was definitely a thing on this island. But as I discovered whilst researching this episode, you can't talk about ancient sun worship on Ibiza without getting into the moon goddess. Because way back when Baal Hamon and his consort Tanit, the moon goddess, arrived on the island of Ibiza via the Carthaginians, it is said that Baal Hamon ended up kind of taking a back seat, and the power and influence and allure of Tanit, the moon goddess, took over on this island for reasons which are still slightly mysterious. But the people of that time believed the presence of Tanit was particularly strong, and that's why Ibiza became home to the most important cave sanctuary to Tanit in the Mediterranean. The cave up in the north near San Vicente, which I've probably mentioned in previous episodes, where in the year 1900 and something, archaeologists found the remains of about 600 clay votives to Tanit, found in the cave near San Vicente, brought there by from other lands, heading out towards the Middle East, the Far East, and Egypt. And in the necropolis which is on the edge of Ibiza town, Puig des Molins, there were also many votives and miniature sculptures that were dedicated to Tanit. But aside from that, even in the houses themselves, those mysterious, whitewashed, thick-walled fincas, the traditional farmhouses of the island of Ibiza, traces to Tanit worship were found, peeling back the layers of whitewash, finding carvings, finding paintings in the walls. And now the theme returns to a man who I've mentioned again and again, in especially in episode one, and that is Rolf Blackstad Sr., the man who arrived to the island in the 1950s with his wife Mary, founded Blackstad Design Consultants, which is now carried on by his son Rolf Jr., and it was Rolf Blackstad Sr.'s absolute passion to trace back these pagan roots of goddess worship on the island. He travelled the island making these stunningly intricate drawings of wells, of the architecture of the island, which is known to be unique to Ibiza and which has very mysterious origins. And in fact, the large body of his work, including his very poetical, mystical writings, has still been largely unshared with the general public. His body of work is being brought together into a volume called Fountains of the Goddess, which of course I'm very excited about. And Rolf Blackstad was friends with Robert Graves, author of The White Goddess, another man, another creator, a writer, very interested in the ancient spirit of the goddess buzzing around these islands, who, of course, moved to the neighbouring island of Mallorca. So, on an aim to discover as much as I could about ancient sun worship on Ibiza, I wanted to find out as much as I could about the mysterious painting, the fresco, on this well where I'm sitting, the Font del Miquelet, which many say represents the Tree of Life with a sun motif at the top. Now, there is a huge mystery behind this painting, as you're going to find out. In the early 70s, Rolf Blackstad Sr. made an exquisite drawing of the painted fresco as he had found it. And in his drawing, which I will put on social media, there was originally a symbol of Tanit above the Tree of Life and above the sun. But the interesting thing is that many years later, in the late 1990s, the government, the Conseil of Ibiza, came and they repainted these frescoes because they get very damp in this cave and they had completely fallen into a bad state again. And they missed out the Tanit symbol and instead they put a circular shape with kind of segments cut in it, which some people have described as a sort of an orange design, and it kind of has much more solar qualities, similar to the flower, the petaled shape beneath it. So I wanted to know what happened with that, and I was curious about the message of Rolf Blackstad Sr., which was always to kind of demonstrate the presence of Tanit in the architecture and the ancient culture of the island of Ibiza. So I was interested to know why it had disappeared, and also this contrast of a motif very connected with the sun, the power of the sun and the solar deities that I've just talked about, and then the moon goddess above it. Is there some kind of ancient power struggle going on here? What is the truth behind this? Now, I got in touch with Martin Davies, writer, translator, founder of Barbary Press, and the man that really anybody on the island should go to if they want to know anything about island culture, literature, any books written in English about the history and the culture of this island. And he got very, very excited, wanting to help me find the answers to this. And last week, we went together to the Blackstad Design Consultants headquarters to have a chat with Rolf Blackstad Jr., who is now the head designer of the company. And his sister came along as well, Sabrina Blackstad, who has also pursued a career in architecture, and she's now the coordinator at the Architectural Association School of Architecture in London. So we ended up having a conversation which I can't say shed that much light on the true meaning of these motifs in relation to sun worship on Ibiza, but it gave some very fascinating hints into the study of the symbols behind the culture of this island, and also the passion of Rolf's father to celebrate Tanit.
And Rolf was the only person to have seen and captured the figure of Tanit back in about 1971, is the date he mentions in his book. Do you think you saw it before then, Rolf?
I'm sure he saw it before then.
Yeah, so when which date did he see it, do you think, come across as well?
I would have thought closer to the early 60s.
Okay, because I was wondering about that, yeah. Mm. And when he, during his kind of wanderings around the island with Mary, his wife, yeah. Is that? Did he ever talk about how he found it?
No, I don't. I've never heard him talk about how he found it. And I think the wanderings would have been actually in the mid to late 50s, because by the time the first daughter was born, Sandra, in 1959, I'm sure that my mother wouldn't have gone anymore on these wanderings in the same way that. But my father continued to travel around. I mean, look at all of the houses and.
And talking of a wanderer, we can perhaps mention the Archduke Louis Salvador, who is the other interesting figure in this mystery, this riddle, because he was also apparently at this well in 1867, which was 100 years before Rolf, and he drew it, and it turned into a wonderful colour lithograph in his masterpiece, the Las Antiguas Pitiusas, the Alten Pitiusen, which was published in 1869. But unfortunately, it's only an exterior view. We do not see what is inside the well chamber. And this is the $100 million question. Was the painting there when the Archduke visited in 1867? He doesn't mention the paintings in his accompanying description, which is another mysterious part of the riddle.
But we also know that sometimes they just become discovered again, because like some of the ones that my father discovered, I remember when we would go as children, he would take us in order to hold the end of the tape measure and help measure all of the houses or whatever he was interested in. And I once got, we'd get really bored by the end because he'd need us at the beginning, and then at least I would then be sitting there for sort of hours as he sketched. Or photographed with a tripod and everything. And so I remember once just being so bored, sitting on one of these sort of half-ruined fincas in the middle of nowhere with nothing to do on a sort of wintry afternoon, and just getting so bored I started to pick away at the whitewash, and then I came across one of the frescoes, the little round flower one, and then I called him. But so you can imagine that maybe at some point when they're restoring or repainting that things come to light. So I don't know about this one, obviously. Yeah.
There is. I've been delving into the well from the local perspective, the local farmers. And yesterday I spoke to Tony Michelet, who was brought up in the house next door, and he recalls the well in his childhood. So this would have been, I mean, he's a bit older than me, 7 years older than me, so that would have been around 1960.
What does he remember seeing inside?
Well, he remembers the paintings. He doesn't, this is the crucial question of whether he saw the Tanit, he can't comment on, and I'm hoping to find someone who does. And even better, someone who took a photo, but I think the chances of that are very remote. Yeah, a photo.
I mean, the question is, you know, if there was a Tanit originally, what was this choice by the Conseil to just put a completely different symbol there? You know, I'm interested in who made that choice and what was the basis for that, because...
Very good question. Well, we were just talking about this earlier, that the archaeologists and Rolf didn't always see eye to eye on certain things. And Rolf thought they were a little bit closed in their opinions about certain matters on Ibiza. I actually spoke with the Conseil's archaeologist, Juan Ramon, about this very thing, because why not go to the horse's mouth, as it were? And he was of the opinion that it was quite impossible that a Tanit would have been painted by the Payeses. You have to remember that Tanit herself is very rare in Spain. So the figures of Tanit, she's found a lot in Carthage, in Numidia, what was Numidia, now Algeria, lots of Tanits there. We should at this stage mention that the actual, what is called the sign of Tanit may not be Tanit. It's a huge debate going on now amongst ancient historians as to what this sign means. For example, in temples dedicated to Baal Hamon in Numidia, there are lots of signs of Tanit, and there's obviously the temple isn't dedicated to her. She was found on the stelas, I don't know how to pronounce this in English, the grave markers in ancient Carthage. That's where she is found above all. The question of her Tanit herself is one of the hottest potatoes in the ancient world, because the Carthaginians themselves never wrote anything down about their religion. We have no idea. So we're trying to piece together this huge puzzle from bits of stone. And this particular symbol in Ibiza is very interesting because she's so rare in Spain. So if she was painted there, who, by, when, and is it real? Which is what the archaeologists maintain she was. Perhaps we were discussing the possibility Rolf saw something like a line or a triangle. And, you know, it's not impossible that someone in all good faith would have represented her, the Tanit symbol, when it wasn't that clear. Perhaps it was another picture. Perhaps
so
it was
certainly another. In the Julian Temple film, the Ibiza Silent movie that I saw a couple of weeks ago, he says, it's not Tanit. So for better or worse, whatever the truth may be, it is coming out in certain sources that somebody says no. And whether that gets picked up as the truth or not, you know, we're in our little post-truth world now. So it is certainly questioned.
Yeah. And Rob, what do you think about the figure that of Tanit on the island?
My feeling in the one in the spring in particular is given the sort of dedication and effort to get into, you know, to detail and document other frescoes in other houses, and we know that they are because we have photographic evidence also that prove that the drawings are correct. Is I can't see, and given the fact that he has also been completely correct in all of the other details in the drawing, why would he have not been correct on this detail?
I agree. I think he was really very conscious of representing it as it was and not fabricating things that weren't there to begin with. Yeah,
completely. And it's also important to point out that this is a well which is filled with sun symbolism, when we all know that really the ancient culture of Ibiza was based around moon worship and moon goddess worship. So it makes sense.
I think we just alluded to a fascinating fresco in the house, which is called this one here, Camarés, is it? Yeah. In which you see a symbol which could be interpreted as a sign of Tanit. And it's like a cross with a triangle at the base. Now, this is where art historians kick in, because the job of an art historian, one of the most important ones, is to interpret evidence. And it's how you interpret the evidence, which is the crucial thing. Someone who says that Tanit was alive and well amongst the Ibizan peasantry, the symbol at least, could see a sign of Tanit in that. Another person might say it's a Christian cross with on the hill of Golgotha, you know, on the hill. So it's difficult to say sometimes what is what.
What
there.
Is that?
That's a photograph of that fresco.
Yep.
Therefore, again, just proving, I think, that in all the cases that we can sort of check the drawings against
are
photographs
accurate.
Is he has been accurate to the detail.
Yeah, yeah, that's a very nice example.
Yeah.
It's a shame that our listeners can't see it, because, if Rolf, this wonderful book is going to be coming out in English, I hope, soon.
It's being printed now.
Okay, so you will be able to buy your copies. It's going to be called The House of Ibiza in English?
That's correct. Yeah.
So look out for that, listeners.
And I'll see if I can put some images on the on the social media to illustrate what we're talking about as well. And does anyone have any general thoughts about the Tree of Life symbol as well, which I find fascinating? I mean, I've seen it written that it's Middle Eastern. Has anyone seen any other similar motifs to this one anywhere else?
Well, again, I've been talking to some of my Ibithinko friends about this particular symbol, particularly the ones who are musicians and who are very interested in drums, because this kind of decoration also appears on musical instruments. Ibithinkos, you know, they use geometric ornaments, and very often they use local plants. Yeah. So whether it's a tree of life, again, whether it's a Tanit symbol, this is why we're debating this, this riddling, I call it, symbolism. Mm-hmm. I should also mention the fact that Tanit was worshipped in North Africa and on Ibiza, we know, because there's a very famous sanctuary here, with a plaque with her name, and that was discovered after the place was excavated. So her kind of rediscovery on Ibiza is comparatively recent. It was thought to be, you know, Astarte's sanctuary. Now, when the cult of Tanit died out in Ibiza, if it ever died out, is a moot point, because Christianity and Judaism were faiths here back in the Dark Ages. Probably the Punic religion died out, certainly in the urban spaces. Rolf's theory is that it survived in the countryside, and that this is where the Phoenician, Carthaginian material culture, etc., and other aspects of their culture carried on. The straight archaeological point of view is that this is not so, that in fact Ibiza was depopulated in the Dark Ages, and that the Carthaginian Phoenician culture died out, and that the Catalan conquest, first of all the Arab conquest and then the Catalan conquest after it, brought in a new wave of culture from the Catalan region, and that the ornaments on the drums and in the well, etc., were created by locals from Catalonia.
Oh, Rolf is now just pointing out a very interesting illustration in the book La Casa Ibithinka.
It's a fresco in what would probably have been a small home altar in Camiguel Toni and Azzaro. And it's clear again that what can't be anything other than the figure of what looks like Tanit.
A figure for sure. Yeah.
Joanna, do you want to mention the lovely paintings in the Libyan oasis in Ghadames near the border with? Do you remember I showed you those wonderful paintings?
Yes. Well, just that there are some really interesting similarities in motifs, definitely. Rolf, do you have any final words about, you know, where you think these motifs originate from? Because you mentioned ancient earlier.
They go back to a much, you know, much more primitive. I think that, you know, they're thousands of years old, and you know, they're extremely common all over the Mediterranean basin, at least North Africa, Near East. And again, you know, to say that you know, there wasn't a tradition to painting, it's. I mean, I'm not in a position to be able to back that up, but I would be, you know, given the fact that over such a short period of time we do, you know, lose the evidence. I mean, I would say it's hard to say one way or the other. I'd say it's equally difficult to defend the argument that they didn't paint them as they did paint them.
Mm-hmm. I mean, we should mention also that they are quite simple geometric designs. It's not the kind of rhomboids, kind of squares with lines and crisscross, and then there's like a plant motif in the middle of the central panel. With this round thing, and then above that, there's Tanit. So you don't need to be Michelangelo to paint that. I mean, it's just, you can just be an ordinary farmer.
Well, yeah. Those sort of motifs you find all over the world. Maybe what's more particular in this one in question is the
what you call the Tree of Life.
The Tree of Life, or the possibly, the symbols above it.
Funny enough, I thought this could be an orange because I discovered a 1765 map, which the well seems to be called the Fuente de Naranjo. And when you go there, the orange trees are very striking and they're very beautiful. The map maker was just a Castilian who happened to be surveying the island and gave him this name. It was probably called the Font de Miguelet back then. It's an old name, 400 years old. I rather like that detail, the oranges.
The orange of life.
Yes, oranges such as...
Remember, we had them, inscribed on the kitchen door. On the ancient kitchen, our kitchen door.
Absolutely.
We had the same symbols were inscribed in the wood.
Literally into the wood carved those figures. So that's why I think, you know, maybe it's in one house you find it on the door, in another house you find it somewhere else. But if you have it in one house, it's... doesn't mean to say that there hadn't been in other houses. There just might not be.
But we've seen them in many houses.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not a question of whether they were common or not. They obviously were. I mean, we've seen them in plenty of houses.
I'm not disputing the commonness of decorating your interior. What I was wondering about was how common it was to paint a well chamber, because very few have survived. I mean, I've been trying to find one myself for 20 years. I'd be delighted to find one.
It's usually actually the springs were maybe not even springs, plastered. Yeah. They were not even plastered inside often, or that we know of.
Yeah.
But going back to naming maps, another sort of snippet, which is a little bit later, which was, I guess it must have been in the late 1970s, they were doing a survey, and basically the same situation as with your Fuente Naranjo is they were trying to name my father's house, and they asked the neighbors, who of course said it was Can Blackstad, and it ended up being Can Blasco, and it still is on the maps.
Topographic
maps. Our Can Miguel de Safon turned into Can Blasco.
Oh, interesting. I think that's a really nice way to finish this recording, because it proves that, you know, you can't be black and white in these matters. Myth and fact are not so black and white. And thanks to your father, Rolf Blackstad Sr., for celebrating this and perhaps proving that, you know, love and devotion to something that you're passionate about is actually the most important thing. I must admit, I do cringe when I listen to that final line of mine at the end of that interview. Very simplistic and very romantic in the company of such intellectual, highly regarded people. But what I was trying to say, I was just trying to stand by Rolf Blackstad Sr.'s passion for not only for finding the facts, not only for researching a myth and getting to the bottom of it intellectually, but also to giving back to it. And to me, Rolf Blackstad wasn't just an architect or a historian, he was an artist, and he created poetic responses to the things that inspired him and touched him on this island. And I can really relate to that as somebody who has also been inspired by these wells and the stories that they contain. And if the power of an ancient moon goddess cult on Ibiza was stronger than the power of those ruling solar deities like Baal Hamon, maybe the reason why is because the ordinary people recognised that harmful potential of the sun, that threat, that danger of the sun. And that's what I'm going to talk a little bit about now. Because, of course, in midsummer, we become more and more aware of the threat that the heat of the sun poses on this island. When underground water levels are down to 51% and the threat of wildfires is at its highest, no fires are allowed to be lit outdoors between May and October on the island because of the risk of fire. And on that subject, I wanted to read you a poem by Robert Hale, who is an Ibiza-based poet, and he is also the main member of a wonderful collective of Ibiza poets called Yabisa's Gas House. And he wrote this poem about the effect of those summer wildfires on the landscapes of Ibiza and the incredible power of Mother Nature to recover afterwards. And the poem is called Song to the Archetypal Forest. Today the spirit moves from the south. The air is thick as I set out. A hot wind fans this rugged land, harsh and sweet as the desert sands. I walk on ways where 5 years since high flames raged and the smoke was dense. The pine trees burned, the birds flew fast, all fled or died as the firestorm passed. And when the flames were finally quenched, you saw a land where life was wrenched, a smouldering waste, a landscape scarred, stone walls scorched and tree stumps charred. Yet even as people cried and railed at the turns of fate, at certainties failed, just as a fever will cleanse the flesh, there's a force at work in the land afresh. As I look on 5 years hence, on these ancient ways where pines were dense, it's a strange, hard, beautiful, different world. A new order begins to unfold. Vital, clambering, fresh and strong, a new world of colour and song. I gaze on the hills in wonder and awe, tenacity springs from every pore. The archetypal forest's plan is death and rebirth and to hell with man's other designs, his need to control, ignoring the greater laws of old. Large pines are gone, juniper too, the land is rough, the trees are few. The ones that stand are but hip height, but all between a glorious sight. Now rosemary, lavender and rock rose reign, butcher's broom and yellow fleabane, wild thyme, heather, spiked ivy vine, each singing a verse to the spirit's rhyme. So the sun is an almighty, intoxicating force, but also a destroyer, a threat, a danger. Now, every day, at the end of the day, something happens all around the world. The sun surrenders his power. He disappears behind the earth. Now, on this little island of Ibiza, something very interesting has happened on the subject of modern-day sun worship. This moment when the sun disappears beneath the horizon, as seen all along the west coast of the island, has become a ritual which, strangely, has become famous around the world. It's become a sort of a theatre spectacle, the Ibiza sunset, and the interesting thing is that it's created a whole new internationally known musical genre, which some call Balearic chill-out music. And it's true. If you walk into any snazzy hotel, I would imagine, shop in New York, in Paris, wherever you want, you could well be listening to a compilation of Balearic chill-out music. Why on earth has the sunset become such a pivotal experience on this little island? And why has it caused such a surge of creativity from these musicians who have chosen to soundtrack that particular moment, that particular astrological moment that happens every day? So I went and I met a man who does exactly that. A man who has a very highly regarded reputation as the Prince of Balearic Chill. He's a musician, he's a producer, he's a DJ. He's currently the resident DJ at Hostal La Torre, which is a beautiful little place on the outskirts of San Antonio, surrounded just by golden-coloured cliffs and deep in nature with spectacular views of the sunset. This man is the resident sunset DJ, and fortunately he is the partner of a friend of mine, so he agreed to be interviewed for a strange little cultural podcast. Thank you.
DJ, producer, musician, highly acclaimed, highly lauded Prince of Balearic Chill. I went and interviewed him last weekend, and I lost the interview. Somehow technology failed me, which is ironic because a lot of what he was talking about to me was how he combines nature with technology in his arc of sunset DJing. So I'm going to try to recap what we talked about in that lost conversation, although I can't really live up to it. And the music that you're listening to is a track called Deep Water from his album Sketches from an Island. So Mark talked me through the six movements which he sees as the structure to a sunset soundtrack, the ones that he plays regularly in his residency at Hostal La Torre. And he went through each stage with me, and it was fascinating to hear. So he told me that stage one would be the early part of the evening, way before the sunset, when he starts off with very, very slow music, really, really embracing stillness, making the moments of stillness and silence last as much as possible. And he mentioned that he enjoys Indian classical music, for example. He sometimes even puts birdsong in. And then moving into the second stage, there's a kind of a very subtle shift in intensity. But he was keen to point out that that doesn't necessarily mean an increase in tempo, but a kind of a change in mood to show that the musical journey is heading towards some kind of particular destination. Mark then said that stage three is a kind of a transition period when sunset is maybe 20 or 30 minutes away, and as a DJ he feels like he's guiding the energy towards that big epic moment where when the sun hits the horizon. And he talks about the drama that he tries to create in that moment, and he makes little tricks to kind of really, really capture the collective concentration of the people who are all staring at this same landscape as he is, the ocean, the horizon. So he might suddenly stop playing music and play some thunder, and he really likes trying to grab the people just to kind of gather the audience as they approach the sunset together. Stage four, he describes as the soundtrack to the sunset itself. So he calls it the kind of payoff shot, when the sun is in the final moments of its journey down towards meeting the ocean. And Mark said that he likes to use a selection of short songs which he mixes in the same key, and he creates what he describes as a mini symphony of high drama and bliss. He talks about how there will only be that sunset. It's a unique event. And in this stage, he really, really needs high levels of concentration to mirror the emotion that he's feeling from that environment. And he also mentioned the magic when you get it right, and the potential for a tear-jerking moment. The fifth movement he describes as when the sun has disappeared beneath the horizon and he plays one song only, a very carefully chosen song for that particular day, for that group of people, for that atmosphere, and one which sort of releases the tension which has built up until that point. And then the final stage of his sunset arc is what he calls the twilight stage. And this is when he kind of drops the tension and the well-planned theoretical stuff. And he just plays songs. He plays songs which prepare people for heading off in their different directions to shift into nocturnal mode. So after hearing about these six stages of the sunset arc, Mark just added a few other really lovely reflections as a DJ who soundtracks this naturally occurring event. He points out that as a DJ who plays music for the sunset, he's very, very different from
the standard dynamic of DJing, in which the DJ takes center stage and all the focus of the audience or the dancers is on him. Instead, in his position, he's actually really behind the audience. They are all facing the ocean, facing the setting sun, and he's behind them also watching the sun. So it's quite an egoless art form, which is interesting because a lot of DJ culture is very, very associated with egoism. And really, he's soundtracking nature rather than taking the center stage himself. I asked Mark about what he sees as the real power and draw of watching the setting sun and why it's become such a huge thing on Ibiza, such a huge collective ritual. And he talks about this sunset watching as a unifying moment in which we witness something much, much greater than us. And it's a moment that forces everyone to be in the present moment. It's a moment of total direct contemplation of nature. And of course, many people only manage to get that and feel that way when they're on holiday in a place like Ibiza. And also, I really liked him mentioning that it's something not many people experience so often, is to sit and witness the shift from day into night, because in our artificially lit lifestyles, we rarely just allow that shift to gently happen around us. And in some ways, it's something which perhaps people are scared to experience because they feel that they're in a strange, unfamiliar, uncertain setting. But watching a sunset on Ibiza is a place where you can truly embrace it. And Mark mentioned that as a DJ, he has to really focus very deeply on the relationship with the people gathered at that particular event, at that particular moment. He talks about matching the speed of the movements of the people that he can see around him as he DJs, and to kind of match their movements, he has to be very, very sensitive to these things. He says that every night and every sunset is completely unique. And he also said something quite fascinating, that he experimented with playing the same set list 2 weeks in a row. And in week one, he had a queue of people lined up afterwards to tell him that they'd found it very moving. And in week two, there wasn't a single compliment at all. So he's so very passionate about this idea that you have to be open to the moment. As a DJ, Mark Barrett creates this score for the setting sun, and really what he's doing is weaving this unique, transient connection between a place, a group of people, and an almighty astrological event, which is incredible, even though it happens every single day. So lovely to hear those thoughts from DJ Mark Barrett. And of course, you can go and experience his arc of sunset DJing several nights a week at the Hostal La Torre on the outskirts of San Antonio. So we've explored the sun today. Merciless power. It sustains, it rules, it controls, it burns, it kills even. And on Ibiza, currently, with mass tourism in full force, the sun is a magnet, attracting so many people to this island that these wells, like the one where I am now, have dried out of water. And I guess I'm left with that lingering mystery of the missing Tanit symbol on this well, above the symbol that some say is the sun. Martin Davis, as you could hear him gently pushing his case in that interview earlier, he still believes that perhaps Rolf Blackstad was a romantic and he wanted a Tanit Thimble to be there. And although he was painstaking in his pursuit of the truth and in accuracy, you know, Martin kind of thinks that every now and again his heart burst into a slightly poetical moment of artistic license. But to me, that's kind of irrelevant, because I think this well needs a symbol of the moon goddess, this dried out well, where even inside the cave, my leg is getting burnt because the rays of the almighty sun have started to creep inside. You can't have a sun god without a moon goddess, and maybe that metaphor sums up the need for balance on this island and in all places around the world. And I'm going to finish with some wonderful words, once again talking about that moment when the solar god, the almighty sun, gives up his power at the end of the day. And when, for example, if you're inland in a valley on this island, perhaps surrounded by pine-forested hills, mountains, there's that moment when the sun sinks behind the mountaintop and slowly you feel the things around you, the creatures, the plants, the life that has been sort of frozen into a stupor by the powerful sun, slowly these things can come back to life again. And maybe that is Mother Earth herself. So I'm going to finish with some words from David Abram, who's the author of Becoming Animal, when he talks about that shift when the sun disappears and the earth comes back to life. And then something shifts. A chill breeze against your face draws you to a different awareness. A final glare, a flaring gleam between two trees silhouetted on that ridge, and then the sun is gone. Some part of your brain that had earlier been rocked to sleep by the soporific dazzle of sunbeams has now been startled into attentive life by this more full-blooded magic. And so you have slipped into a different realm, a different mindscape. You've entered the country of shadow, and a vast and brooding presence that had been hiding moments earlier behind the gauze of light is now slowly walking toward you through the clarified air. It is the breathing body of the mountain itself. You've been listening to The Wells of Tanit, hosted by me, Joanna Ruby. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please spread the word. Follow us on Instagram and Facebook, subscribe to us on iTunes and give us a good review. We're very grateful to the Abethan folk group Uk and their record label Productions Blau for letting us use the song De Joad Vas Despedient as our theme music. I'll see you next time, and in the meantime, may your island wanderings lead you to those forgotten ancient places where the waters of inspiration always flow. To the wells of Tanit. Compania quedant jo en su pensament i es mateix que abans tenia no l'he transmudat de res dels tractus que els dos teníem jo seguiré lo mateix visquent amb molta alegria. I a conhortat després de lo que mos pervendria, i en sé que no et sé ni et veig, que això et content algun dia. Per això no t'abandon i has de pensar
pensa que t'oblidi, que dins mon cor repeteix lo que em deies aquell dia. Sempre t'apreciaré i on se fuia que sigues només per dar-te entenent que de tu estic agraïda.